I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. In 1967, Richard Blanco's parents left Cuba, flew to Madrid, Spain, where Blanco was born, and a short time later immigrated to the U.S., settling in Miami in a close-knit community of other Cuban exiles. And like other children of immigrants, Blanco grew up feeling his parents' angst about being cut off from their homeland and his own divided loyalties about becoming Americanized. He and his brother were the translators for his parents and grandparents, something Blanco wrote about in his memoir, The Prince of Los Cocuyos. Many years later, in 2013, he delivered his poem, One Today, for President Obama's second swearing-in, the first Latino, the first immigrant, the first openly gay man to be an inaugural poet. He whispered to his mother before stepping up to the podium, "Mama, I think we're finally Americanos." Richard Blanco has a new book of poetry, How to Love a Country, with poems that are both personal and political about nationhood and what it means, especially in a country as divided as the United States. He's the education ambassador for the Academy of American Poets and joins us once again on Radio Times. Richard Blanco, nice to have you back with us.
Wonderful to be back.
Very nice to have you back with us. And do you still feel Americano?
Well, you know, I've gone through my phases, as you were noting in the beginning, being surrounded by all Cubans. You wanted to be what you weren't, what you didn't see around you. So there was that sense and that yearning for being Americano, and then discovering, as the memoir talks about, sort of a cultural coming of age and a renaissance. Well, not a renaissance, but really embracing my Cuban self and going to Cuba. And then I became Joe Cuba, and I was like, and then I read
many personalities, right?
And then I read every, you know, sort of had my anti-American phase. Reading, you know, sort of the real history, not the ones they gave us in our eighth grade textbooks, and then slowly questioning that and exploring the world and trying to find a place, and then really the culminating point was the inauguration. I mean, if when the president of the United States asks you to write a poem for the entire country, you kind of do start to feel maybe I do belong here. But that moment really was a defining moment. Even until that moment, I still felt part of me still felt. I'm not part of that American narrative. And the greatest gift of the inauguration was to realize that my story as a Cuban gay kid who grew up in a working class family, that's part of the American narrative. And the honor of representing not only feeling that for myself, but representing it for so many people that probably grow up feeling or still feel in the margins. And then with Cuba, when they asked me to write and read a poem for the reopening of the U.S. Embassy in Cuba, then I started having my romantic gestures towards the island. I was like, maybe I'm Cuban a little now, or maybe I can get a retirement home over here. And that taught me that really I didn't have to pick that experience.
You
can be all these things, which I think is the world we're living in now, where you can be, you don't have to pick. Or some people have five things to pick from. How could you possibly five different kinds of identities as some of my students do? So that was sort of the quick journey of my relationship with home, country, place, identity.
Do you think, though, it's interesting thinking about today where gay marriage is legal, but immigration is as fraught as ever, that we're in this sort of curious place in America, it seems?
Yeah, I think that's part of a lot of what I take up in the new book of poetry and How to Love a Country, looking also at historical other kinds of immigration stories we're not as familiar with, like the Asian American or Chinese American immigration through Angel Island, and realizing that there's a historical that we have flip-flopped on immigration in different ways and with different groups, and it's a complex issue, but I will say, as I've been saying at my readings, I've been hearing about especially the Mexico-U.S. problem, quote-unquote, since I was a kid. And I'm kind of – and I'm at this point thinking, really, there's no fair and equitable solution, compromise, something that can happen that – can fix what is apparently a problem only to politicians, right? So thinking about in a poem how, and also given my Latin American background, there's more complexity to it than I think that even the news reports, right? It's not just the United States and it's not just the Central Mexico and Central America, but really there's something more going on, mm-hmm. and I think part of it is just geopolitical power grabs and things like that. Nobody wants poor, destitute people, right? And so And so I think that's part of what's happening. And I wish the news would report more on it. I'm looking at it through the lens of poetry, but I think there's more to it than meets the eye.
Well, it sounds like poets, if you're representing all poets in America, but if the poets are more optimistic, the journalists are more, they see something that journalists don't see.
Yeah, and I think it's the human story, and I think it's part of what I, you know, I don't consider myself a political poet even in this book, but part of what I try to do is to put real names, faces, lives, and stories to these issues that get abstracted, social political issues that get abstracted, get skewed, and we lose sight of the human story. You know, my mentor Campbell McGrath always said that part of being a poet is being an emotional historian. Uh-huh. And I even do that in terms of my own Cuban family and my community and my elders, and thinking about recording their emotional stories, right? So and so, you know, I think we dig in a different way. I think there's all sorts of stories to tell.
I want to have you read Mother Country.
Sure.
And I should say to our listeners that this was one of the poems that you submitted to the Obama administration for the second inaugural. They did not choose it.
Right.
but I think there's so much in here, and especially, I think, related to the title of your book, How to Love a Country.
Yeah, and actually, you hit it right on the nose, Marty, because this is where the title sort of began for the book. It got evolved a little bit, but it comes from this. Yes, this was the third poem that they chose, and I just, as you'll see, I just wanted myself and the reader, to put themselves in my mother's emotional shoes and her journey out of Cuba, to maybe think about how we can look at our own country through the eyes of an immigrant that sort of always reminds us of those ideals and holds those ideals up to the light because of these journeys that they risk their lives for and lose family and whatnot. Mother Country, Madre Patria. To love a country as if you've lost one. 1967, my mother leaves Cuba for America, a scene I imagine as if standing in her place. One foot inside a plane destined for a country she knew only as a name, a color on a map, or glossy photos from drugstore magazines. Her other foot anchored to the platform of her patria, her hand clutched around one suitcase, taking only what she needs most, hand-colored photographs of her family, her wedding veil, the doorknob of her house, a jar of dirt from her backyard, goodbye letters she won't open for years. The sorrowful drone of engines, one last deep breath, a familiar air she'll take with her. One last glimpse at all she'd ever known. The palm trees wave goodbye as she steps onto the plane. The mountains shrink from her eyes as she lifts off into another life to love a country as if you've lost one. I hear her once upon a time, reading picture books over my shoulder at bedtime, both of us learning English, sounding out words as strange as the talking animals and fair-haired princesses in their pages. I taste her first attempts at macaroni and cheese, but with chorizo and peppers, and her shame over Thanksgiving turkeys, always dry, but countered by her perfect pork pernil and garlic yuca. I smell the rain of those mornings, huddled as one under one umbrella, waiting for the bus to her 10-hour days at the cash register. And at night, the zzz, zzz of her sewing her own blouses and quinceañera dresses for her grown nieces still in Cuba, guessing at their sizes. And the gowns she'd sell to neighbors to save for a rusty white sedan, no hubcaps, no air conditioning, sweating all the way through our first vacation to Florida theme parks to love a country, as if you've lost one, as if it were you on a plane departing from America forever. Clouds closing like curtains on your country, the last scene in which you're a madman scribbling the names of your favorite flowers, trees, and birds you'd never see again, your address and phone number you'd never use again, the color of your father's eyes and your mother's hair, terrified you could someday, somehow, forget these. To love a country. As if I was my mother last spring, hobbling, insisting I help her climb all the way up to the U.S. Capitol, as if she were here before you today instead of me, explaining her tears, her cheeks pink as the cherry blossoms coloring the air that day, when she stopped, turned to me, and said, "You know, mijo, it isn't where you're born that matters. It's where you choose to die. That's your country."
And that's our guest, Richard Blanco, reading from his new book of poetry, How to Love a Country, a poem titled Mother Country. And there's so much in there. There's sadness and loss and memories and grief, but also being in a country where her son is the inaugural poet.
Yeah, there's this great, you know, my mother has been my, in a weird way, my lifeline, in a weird way, but an ironic way, perhaps, my lifeline to Cuba, because she left, it's not in the poem, but her entire family behind, her parents, eight brothers and sisters, every living relative. But in a way, because of her quest for the American dream, she's also sort of my sort of guiding light and my sort of reminder of what that really means, right? All the sacrifices she made, all, in fact, you know, just, you know, working those 10-hour days so I could have an education, insisting on go to college, et cetera, et cetera. All those decisions that she made and sacrificed eventually put me up on the podium in Washington in some way, right? In a way, that was a story that was begun by her journey. And just thinking about, you know, she always reminds me again of those ideas. And in that way, you know, I am optimistically patriotic always, because of I see the color, the world, the our country through her eyes often.
Well, I think this poem also underscores that we do say mother country, and we say father land,
right?
We say mother country. I mean, that there is something maternal about the idea of country.
Yeah, and I know in Spanish, I'm going to try to think real quick. I don't think there's an equivalent of fatherland. They say madre patria.
And
it's not in the title, but I always say it because it's this la madre patria. And yeah, that
the place that nurtured you, that brought you to life.
Right.
That...
So there's a layer of that, which is her, but also, of course, it's her and then what she represents in terms of this country. So it's not right. Usually we have the fatherland is what we use more.
But that feels so different, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. The idea of nurture versus dictating, right?
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Richard Blanco, our guest on Radio Times today. He's a poet and he's got a brand new book of poetry called How to Love a Country. He just read a poem from that, Mother Country. He'll be reading some more of them as well. And he's the education ambassador for the Academy of American Poets. He was the inaugural poet at President Obama's second inauguration. And he's been basically living out of a suitcase ever since, flying across the country talking about poetry and why it matters. You can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Richard Blanco, again, a presidential inaugural poet for President Obama, author of two memoirs, also several collections of poetry, including his new book of poems called How to Love a Country. While that poem that you just read is sort of resonating, before we move on to another one, you also write about, and I don't know if it's true for people in exile who are sort of forced to leave their country, or whether immigrants feel this more broadly, which is in the home country, nothing tastes as good as the mangoes,
right,
or nothing is as beautiful as the sunset, or nothing is as whatever, which is interesting to think about loving a country, but also what you have left behind and how maybe things were better there.
Yeah. With exiles, I think it's a shared experience, that sense of nostalgia, whether one is an immigrant or exile. In the exile, I think it's perhaps more exaggerated, because there isn't necessarily always that they want to leave because of certain circumstances, but sometimes they just have to leave. Their lives are in danger. So So, and there's always this idea that we're returning to, that the country's going to change. So it gets more and more nostalgic over time. And it really is an interesting space because I'm growing up as such. On the one hand, they want you to be Americano.
Exactly.
They want you to be successful in this country. But then they're like, you're too Americano, right? So there's a fine line.
Did you ever find that fine line?
Yeah. I mean, even today, my mom, like, sort of, even after experiencing the inauguration, she kind of reminds me that I'm, you know, that I'm still from this little boy from Westchester. And it's, I think it's hard for her to grasp that immensity of, which, of course, she dreamed for me, right, in some ways, right, without even knowing. So I still have to come back to center a lot. But yeah, it's really an interesting space to negotiate.
I'd love to have you read, it's called Como Tu, or Like You, Like Me. And this is another poem from your new collection.
Yeah. And this is actually relates to what you were talking about. So I arrived at 45 days old from Spain in my mother's arms. And so I had no choice in coming to this country. And when all this DACA and the Dreamers thing was, I still don't know where that even lies today, right? The repeal and then not the repeal and the deal and whatnot. I was putting myself in the shoes and suddenly feeling, wow, I came as a documented immigrant. But in some ways, I know Cuba culturally, but I couldn't imagine just going back to Cuba to live because it's not really my country. So it's a cultural attachment, but there's nothing beyond that. It's its own place. So this is a poem of camaraderie and sort of compassion and cheerleading and championing the emotions that I must feel, the dreamers must feel. And there's a little epigraph by the Salvadoranian poet Roque Dalton, which I'll read first.
Sure.
Mis venas no terminan en mí, sino en la sangre unánime de los que luchan por la vida. My veins don't end in me, but in the unanimous blood of those who struggle for life. Como tú, like you, like me. Como tú, I question history's blur in my eyes each time I face a mirror. Like a mirror, I gaze into my palm, a wrinkled map I can't read, my lifeline, an unmade road I can't find, can't trace back to the fork in my parents' track that cradled me here. Como tú, I woke up to this dream of a country I didn't choose, that didn't choose me, trapped in the nightmare of its hateful glares. Como tú, I'm also from the lakes and farms, waterfalls and prairies of another country I can't fully claim either. Como tú, I'm either a mirage living among these faces and streets that raised me here, or I'm nothing, a memory, forgotten by all I was taken from and can't return to again. Like memory, at times I wish I could erase the music of my name in Spanish. At times I cherish it and despise my other syllables clashing in English. Como tú, I want to speak of myself in two languages at once. Despite my two tongues, no word defines me. Like words, I read my footprints like my past, erased by waves of circumstance. My future uncertain as wind, like the wind. Como tú, I carry songs, howls, whispers, thunders growl. Like thunder, I'm a foreign-born cloud that's drifted here. I'm lightning and the balm of rain. Como tú, our blood rains for the dirty thirst of this land. Like thirst, like hunger, we ache with the need to save ourselves and our country from itself.
And again, that's Richard Blanco reading from his new book of poetry, Como Tú, Like You, Like Me, a very powerful poem, I should say, very timely as well. There is that empathy, but as you also seem to indicate, this anger, too, at America.
Yeah, in the sense of, I just feel this is one of the most unjust, because I can viscerally feel, what if someone took me right now and put me in Cuba, it just feels so inhumane. And the poem, I just had never had found that kind of connection. As when I started really thinking about when this really sort of became an issue that came to bear with this presidency. And there's also this idea, though, in that poem that I think is important, and it is, I think it speaks to the migrations of people that we're seeing throughout the globe, the displacements of people. In light of, in some ways, you know, there's these two things that are competing against each other. And it's this idea of globalization and interconnectivity through our economies, through communication, through modes of transportation. And yet then there's this kind of displacement that happens. So, you know, something I think it speaks to a moment in our in not just in United States history, but it's happening in other places. And thinking about what does that mean, and what do borders really mean anymore, and that kind of in contrast to the reality, this organic narrative that is what's really happening to us as a species, right? Sorry, I'm getting really deep.
Bring it on. But fear, I mean, it seems that, you know, people are afraid. It's a fearful world.
Yeah, and I can tell
a changing world.
And I can tell you, you know, it's scary to be homogenized. I can speak to that as a gay Cuban American and an engineer.
Yeah, we'll get to the engineer part. But yes.
You know, you want to be different all the time, but you're also at the same time wanting to be accepted and wanting to be part of the mainstream. But there's a weird human sort of nature, part of human nature is like we don't want to just be like everybody else either. So I think part of the challenge of the 21st century that we're seeing, especially for the next generation, is how do we celebrate diversity? How do we respect cultures? How do we define ourselves individually, but yet knowing that really our ultimate goal is to become one people, and at this point, for the sake of the planet, you know. So it gets into even a deeper layer than that. And I think what you see with Brexit, for example, or our own presidency right now, or other parts of the world, I think we were talking about Hungary earlier, right, is a knee-jerk reaction. And I have a somewhat of empathy, but I think it's also up to the leaders to not sort of feed on our fears, but rather feed on our hope that we can be ourselves and still be united with other countries within our own country, and to start there.
Can poets, though, show us the way?
I think that's part of
poetry, maybe.
Poetry, I think, you know, I gotta say, Maria, I certainly believe so, but not in this grand sort of broad stroke. You know, poetry can change the world or save the world. As I always say, you know, a poem can't change the world. It's just, don't be silly. But it can change a person. This is what I fundamentally believe. Not only just poetry, but all arts have this ripple effect, because what they plant in us is ultimately is empathy and how to understand what another human being's life is like. And so I think, you know, what if, you know, I always think, well, maybe, you know, there's a little Barack Obama that read a poem by someone that might, you know, and so people change the world, but poems stimulate that. I think all the humanities really stimulate that kind of change, and it's not always tangible, not always something you can measure, but certainly something that I write out of sort of that belief that there's ripples and people that I'll never meet who've read my poems perhaps and have had something changed in their life.
There's a mirror in this poem. I mean, you reference a mirror, and I notice in several of other of your poems, mirrors are there.
Yeah,
I mean, looking in the mirror.
It's very observant, yes.
But what is that about? What does that mean for you?
You know, I think that the mirror is always this question of identity, and I'm still fascinated. Like, I don't know, maybe it's just a poet geek thing. But you know when you catch your eyes in the mirror, that deep stare into the mirror? And I always remember that
I try not to look at mirrors, but that's a whole other thing.
Yeah. I'm thinking I'm doing that a lot less after 52. I'm thinking, I used to do that a lot when I was in my 20s. No. But I think since a little kid, as a gay kid, as a Cuban kid, I think that deep stare was always a questioning of who I am and what is that space, what is that soul, and what does that my soul want? And I think
who's looking
back at me, yeah, and who's, you know, and it's funny, that's a great observation, is nobody's ever really picked that up. But yeah,
including your inaugural poem.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a mirror in there.
Yeah. It's always this mirroring, I think, and I think it all has to do basically with identity. How to identify by looking at yourself or that other self or that self that you don't see every day and you're not, you know, that deeper self. Yeah.
You mentioned engineering, and you actually studied engineering in college. Obviously gave it up, but I wonder whether creating poetry or building a poem has requires some engineering skills.
Oh, it's it's amazing how siloed our education has become. And so I have been a practicing civil engineer also. So I'm speaking out of experience too. It's not I didn't just get the degree and throw it away. Whereas I like to say sometimes I wanted to go into poetry full time because there was so much money. But I had an ethical obligation to stay a few years in engineering. But there's incredible, you know, poetry is so much about structure, about logic, about finding an internal logic to the poem and then breaking it. It's about organizational principles. Even putting a book together has a structure, right? How one poem leads into another. It's almost like how one trust, one member of a trust leads, ties into another to build a bridge. And I get that a lot, not so much from the practice of engineering, but all the math. I mean, I have to take up to calculus 5, so you can imagine.
Oh, my goodness.
And the opposite is also true. I learned how to write as an engineer. That's when my first year in my engineering office, consulting office, my job was 50% writing. And so I suddenly dove into language, and I wasn't prepared for it, and realized that language was so crucial and critical to my success as being an engineer. You write a $400 million proposal, it's nothing but a narrative, and nobody asks you to write it to solve a calculus problem. They assume you know how to. But it's a story. You're telling a story about your vision for the project. You're telling a story about your sort of padding exaggerating the accolades of your firm, right? And I think I've developed a course for engineers actually at Wentworth Institute, which is an engineering university in Boston, to show them how important the humanities are in general beyond writing, because engineers come out of school without understanding the idea of a user, right? That you're somebody's going to cross this bridge. Somebody's going to play in this park. Somebody's going to have their first kiss on that bench that you're putting in. These are things that people live with. And I think the great inventors, you take Steve Jobs, I mean, the idea of him humanizing the computer, and he, if I'm not mistaken, he attributes that to reading so much literature and being able to, remember when that first came out and the computer would say hi, that was crazy, right?
And people and have fonts matter.
Right, and people have this human relationship. I mean, what's the Windows guy?
Oh, yeah. What is that? Yeah, that guy.
When he passes, they'll just throw him in the river. No, but so there's a lot of humanities that gets left out of engineering. And I think, as we all know, I think success in any career, in any human endeavor, involves a plethora of skills and connections in some ways.
And that's our guest, poet Richard Blanco, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I think we can squeeze in your poem, What We Didn't Know About Cuba.
Okay, sure. let's look at that one. So
yeah, and that's on page 22.
Yeah. This poem, I forgot to mention, part of the book is are poems that were based on photographs by a collaborative project that was a limited press project, a limited edition press project. And this was actually a photo based on a photo of Hallandale Beach in just north of Miami, which is where most of the rafters, Cuban rafters, land because of the currents. But it's just the photograph is just sort of a prompt for what this poem became. What we didn't know about Cuba for Emilio. Just a hired driver, or so Rita and I thought, his Cuban-American tourists for the day, as we drove off from our sea-scoured hotel in Havana east to Matanzas, a town known for great poets but named after a massacre, he said, offering us water and mints, looking at us through the rearview mirror of his dinged but freshly waxed sedan. The seats faded but spotless, a cracked windshield but immaculate dashboard. San Lazaro's sacred but sad eyes watching from a prayer card tucked in the visor. A real macho cubano, tall in his seat and stiff as his starched guayabera, his eyes hidden by aviator sunglasses. He spoke only to ask if we were hungry or needed a restroom, only gave one-word answers to our questions. Are you married? Si. Any children? Si. Any family in Miami? No. Would you leave Cuba? Si. Much like Rita's father and my own, a man we'd never quite know, or so it seemed. We turned our attention, began speaking to each other in English, believing he only spoke Spanish. As he kept his eyes on the road, we kept talking about building cultural bridges to and from Cuba, wanting to mend it ourselves. As he hugged the curves along the coast, we clung to our ideas about the power of poetry to create dialogue and shape the island's future. We chatted mile after mile to Matanzas, where, as planned, we spent the day at an art gallery, sharing poems about our hopes, our losses. Praised by applause, pleased with ourselves, we strolled back to the car, where he'd waited, sleeping all afternoon. We had asked him to join us, but he refused. Minutes after we left Matanzas, he pulled over near a cliff edging the azure waters of a cove. "Disculpe," he said, and stepped out with his cell phone in hand. He returned, sighed into his seat, grabbed San Lázaro and ripped him in half. He tore his sunglasses off, pinched his eyes. Two hazel stars exploded with sudden tears. Everything. The seagulls, the palm trees, the shadows, the sunset, its rusty clouds, the waves, the wind, and our next breath stopped until he breathed again, yelled in broken English at the broken windshield. "She gone, left us like nothing. She, his wife, mother of his son, she adrift on a raft hoping for Florida, her vow of for better or worse, broken like this damn country. Why?" he asked, a rhetorical question we thought, but no, it was meant for us. "Why don't you write a damn poem about this? Why?" he repeated. To us, to the sea, to the horizon, to her ghost, already dawning in dusk's far, fleeting light.
Why, what we didn't know about Cuba. We'll be right back. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And if you're just joining us, Richard Blanco is our guest. He was President Obama's inaugural poet for his second term in office, also the author of two memoirs and several collections of poetry. And he's been reading from his new book of poetry called How to Love a Country. And again, you can join our conversation. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. How many times have you been to Cuba?
First trip was in 1994, and that was part of, again, this cultural coming of age. And I had written, so I'd started writing poetry, and poetry started making me dig deeper and thinking about my culture. And then just came a point, I was like, I have to go to the mother country, so to speak. So that was 94. And then I've gone every 3 or 4 or 5 years, less and less throughout the years as my cousins, some of my first cousins or several have immigrated or been exiled in Miami. So I get to see some more of them. But I don't go as often as I should because it's a really confusing. It's wonderful and confusing at the same time. It's very
confusing because of your own
connection, right? There's connection. a little disorienting because there's always this sense of you're walking around with this question: what if my parents never left? Who would I be? And wondering, it's like just thinking about this, it feels like there's this ghost of you somewhere that you're trying to find, or a twin that was left behind somehow who's still there, and like this parallel life that you always wonder. And it's wonderful because you feel so connected, and at the same time feel also disconnected in some ways, because you also, as they say, you realize how American you are when you travel anywhere, right?
No question. Well, I'd love to have you read another poem from your book, and this is about your father.
Yeah. This is a very simple poem. Actually, it's a poem really about praise and gratitude. In some ways, my father lost, like my mother, but in different ways. His whole family came, but I think as a man of that generation, that kind of displacement, that not being able to be the macho that took care of his family, and he had to change all his dreams and. In a way, somewhat emasculated by exile, if that makes sense. And so this is part of his story. my father in English. First half of his life lived in Spanish, the long syntax of Las Montañas that lined his village, the rhyme of sol with his soul, a Cuban alma that swayed with Las Palmas, the sharp rhythm of his machete cutting through caña, the syllables of his canarios that sung into la brisa of the island home. He left to spell out the second half of his life in English, in the vernacular of New York City, sleet, neon, and glass, and the brick factory where he learned to polish steel 12 hours a day. Enough to save enough to buy a used Spanish-English dictionary, he kept bedside like a Bible, studied 15 new words after his prayers each night, then practiced them on us the next day. Buenos dias, indeed, my family. Indeed, mas café. Have a good day today, indeed. And again in the evening. Gracias to my bella wife, indeed, for dinner. ¿Hiciste tu homework? Indeed. La vida es, indeed, difícil. Indeed, did indeed become his favorite word, which, like the rest of his new life, he never quite grasped, overused, and misused, often to my embarrassment. Yet the word I most learned to love and know him through. Indeed, the exile who tried to master the language he chose to master him. Indeed, the husband who refused to say, I love you, in English to my mother. Indeed, the man who died without true translation. Indeed, meaning in fact and efecto, meaning in reality, de hecho, meaning to say now what I always meant to tell him in both languages. Thank you, gracias, for surrendering the past tense of your life so that I might conjugate myself here in the present of this country. In truth, así es, indeed.
I love that poem. That's Richard Blanco reading from his new book of poetry, How to Love a Country, My Father in English. There is so much there. And you and your brother were also translators for right. much of your family, including, I'm assuming, for your father, as much as he tried to learn this English language.
Yeah, I think in part, that's why I always wonder why the hell I became a poet.
Really?
And in part, I think there was such an attention to language from a very early age, getting here at 45 days old. And really, I don't remember ever knowing just one language. I don't remember having a first language. So from an early age, more so than my brother, because he was already 6.5 years old, but I learned English by the time I was 2 or 3. And I remember my parents asking me, even at that young age, not full conversations, but how do you say, you know, mug? You know, how do you say taza? How do you say these little things? And eventually later, holding this linguistic power over them once we left Miami, right? And then the roles were reversed, and it was through language that they had to depend on us for many things. Now, I don't want to – they did go to night school and learn some English. They had some kind of a working knowledge of English, but they were terrified to speak it because as anybody who's tried to learn a second language at an older age, you realize you just feel so stupid
and you can't really find the word,
and it's not a good feeling. So you run away from it often, yeah.
Your dad died when you were in your 20s, and the line that I underscored here is the man who died without true translation, and I think – for many kids, they feel, even if their parents spoke English for morning, noon, and night, the thought of a parent who wasn't totally translated, not totally understood or knowable.
Yeah, and I think partly it's the circularity of that. Partly was that I think he became somewhat emotionally handicapped, or really it's almost like a PTSD kind of reaction. I mean, my mother leaves 7.5 months pregnant to Cuba, suitcase, 50 cents in their pocket, 6.5-year-old, another 6.5-year-old son. 4 months later, they moved to the United States. And I think it just stifled him. And so, ironically, not just linguistically, but emotionally. And that did a number on him. And so, with my parents in particular, maybe it's particular to Cubans because we have such an enclave in Miami, they really just never really – they adopted the country in ideals and in spirits, and they feel in one sense very American. But they never – were never – acculturated. I mean, they were never sort of, what's the word I'm looking for?
Comfortable?
Well, they never converted, so to speak. They weren't acclimated completely into the new culture. So there's a certain sense of loss. You know, like part of it has to do with socioeconomics too. But you know, living in in other words, they never forgot their Cuba, even as much as they loved and appreciated this country. And I think that added to more another kind of sense of loss and sort of.
You said we could spend a whole hour on this, which we don't have, and I feel badly about that. That's about the sort of machismo culture, that it was really, at least from your experience, it's the women that sort of carry on this culture of machismo, whereas the men are more soft-hearted, even if on the surface they may look rough and tough.
Yeah, a lot of machismo is about pretense, and I think you see this in other cultures. I think we see it in African American cultures as well. You know, this idea that the man is always sort of propped up to make believe that he's in charge, but really, who's running the show is always the women, in many different ways, and are very powerful women and very powerful figures. And that's an example too. My father was actually a very quiet man, a very docile man, whereas my mother was much more of a presence. I mean, and
your grandmother, and even more so.
My grandmother was a force of nature, and they ran the whole show, yet they wouldn't take credit for it, right? They'd be like, okay, well, whatever, yeah, you're your slippers or whatnot. But it's also – and then when you intersect sexuality into there, there's another layer of that too. So it's the homophobia, the exhibitism in machismo, the real crime is not so much the idea of a religious-based kind of – it's damnation, but rather it's – the real crime is to be feminine, right, to be a feminine man. What you do behind closed doors. So there's another kind of homophobia that happens that's connected to culture, or a cultural sexuality, as I like to say.
Well, speaking of homophobia, speaking of sexuality, I want to have you read at least a section from Until We Could. And this was something that you wrote part of the anniversary of the right to marry legislation.
Yeah, it was a poem for the 10th year anniversary of Freedom to Marry, which is the organization that really fought for that, and they made it into a short film, very wonderfully produced, and you can look it up on YouTube. Until We Could, Richard Blanco, Freedom to Marry. So I'll just read maybe the first stanza and see where we land. Okay, and this is dedicated to my husband. Well, not my husband. I've always said my husband, we've been together 20 years, but he just proposed to me on Friday. So if you're listening, Mark. This is for you. I knew it then, when we first found our eyes in our eyes, and everything around us, even the din and smoke of the city, disappeared, leaving us alone, as if we were the only two men in the world, two mirrors, face to face, my reflection in yours, yours in mine, infinite. I knew, since I knew you, but we couldn't. I caught the sunlight pining through the shears, traveling millions of dark miles simply to graze your skin. As I did that first dawn, I studied you sleeping beside me. I counted your eyelashes, read your dreams like butterflies flitting under your eyelids and ready to flutter into the room. Yes, I praised you like a majestic creature my God forgot to create. Till that morning of you tamed in my arms, first for me to see, name you mine. Yes, to the rise and fall of your body, your every exhale and inhale, a breath I breathed, wanting to keep even the air between us as one. Yes, to all of you. Yes, I knew. But still, we couldn't. So we'll sort of skip forward, and that we couldn't becomes the refrain. And let me skip forward to...
Maybe love is the right.
Yeah, exactly. Read my mind. Love is the right to say, I do, and I do, and I do. And I do want us to see every tulip we've planted come up spring after spring. 100 more years of dinners cooked over a shared glass of wine, and 1,000 more movies in bed. I do. Until our eyes become voices, speaking without speaking. Until, like a cloud meshed into a cloud, there's no more you, me. Our name's useless. I do want you to be the last face I see, my breath, your breath. I do. I do and will for those who still can't vow it yet, but know love's exact reason as much as they know how sail keeps the wind without breaking, or how roots dig a way into the earth, or how the stars open their eyes to the night, or how a vine becomes one with the wall it loves, or how, when I hold you, you are still rain in my hands.
Again, that's Richard Blanco reading from his new book of poetry, How to Love a Country, and that's a poem titled Until We Could. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. All right, so we all have bated breath because okay. Mark proposed to you.
Right.
and what a beautiful love poem, I should say, even before we get to that.
You.
But and it's dedicated to him. And you can marry.
And you can, yeah.
If you want.
It's a
big decision.
Well, it was funny as we kind of like, it's interesting because growing up in our generation, we really had no role model. So like, okay, the man asked the woman, like, you know, to marry, like, we're still sort of trapped, not trapped, but there's still that. So just like a month ago, I said, you know, if somebody doesn't propose, this is never going to happen. And it ain't going to be me because I'm too cheap to buy a ring. No.
Is that true? I
no,
mean,
no.
You wanted him to propose?
Yeah, I think in part I identify in that relationship as that person. I'm like the homebody. I'm the one. I'm the domestic. And, of course, God is a comedian, makes me the poet that earns a living by being on the road 70% right. of his time and has supported the household for 5 years, go figure. Well, not wholly, but certainly we've had our – anyway,
yeah.
We've had our different times where we're each more gainfully employed. But I've always seen myself in some weird way still wanting that to be that – 1950s housewife basting turkeys and pearls and with a pearl choker and a pleated skirt. That world that never.
I totally
never...
get it, by the way.
So I was like, so he did it.
So he did it. He did it.
Yeah.
And
I said yes.
And you said yes.
But it's funny. And then I announced it also to all. He proposed in Miami and everybody's making plans. And now it's suddenly, it's really what's true what they say. Now it really feels real. I think what happened is both our parents, well, my mother and his parents are getting older. We're realizing the passage of time. And I think we thought this would be a beautiful thing, not just for us, but to share. Our friends are getting older. You never know. You know, things happen. So while we're still can do it and can finally do it, let's do it.
Well, on that note, first of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
Richard Blanco, and thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's been amazing. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. And again, his new book is How to Love a Country. He's written two memoirs, including one that he was a guest on Radio Times talking about a couple of years ago called The Prince of Los Cocuyos. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.